Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Jeff Singer and Professor Eric Smith. Dr. Singer is a friend of Daily Remedy and is a general surgeon in Phoenix, Arizona. He's also the senior fellow at the Cato Institute. And joining us today is Professor Eric Smith, who's a research fellow at the Cato Institute and associate professor of rhetoric at York College in Pennsylvania. Today we're here to discuss DEI in medical studies, and specifically focus on the article that was recently written in National Review titled, Discrimination and Identity Politics Have No Place in Medical Education. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Singer and Professor Smith.
Thank you.
Hello.
Before we jump into various aspects of the article itself, I want to start high level and really just contextualize the conversation for the audience. Can you start perhaps Professor Smith, with explaining what is DEI in medical education and how does it manifest at the medical school level?
Well, DEI, as we're talking about it anyway, not as it's supposed to be, is an ideology and methodology based on what's called critical social justice. And this ideology of critical social justice abides by a us versus them, oppressor versus oppressed narrative. And goes primarily by this particular tenet. The question isn't, did racism happen, but how did it manifest in this situation? Which is to say that racism is always already going on. We just have to find it and root it out. So the idea is that society, particularly Western civilization, and particularly the United States, is inherently racist. To the point where the United States of America is a synonymous term with white supremacist culture, right? So with that idea, it has gotten into education, the humanities initially, but it's spread to other places, math even, and now obviously medicine. And it manifests in ways that are particularly ideological and not at all pragmatic. What I mean by that is if you're going to med school, you're there to learn how to practice medicine. But the social reality that aligns with critical social justice is you're there to root out racism and discrimination once and for all, by way of medicine, right? And critical social justice is something that has roots in Marxist theory, cultural Marxism. People often cite the Frankfurt School as a place where this really started rolling. But I think it's interesting that, you know, communist regimes do the same thing with education. I recall Lenin speaking to the communist youth of Russia soon after the Bolshevists took over. And he said, you know, teaching math for its own sake is immoral, right? It should be math insofar as it supports communism. Right. It should be fill in the blank insofar as it supports communism. We're seeing that now. Yes, practice medicine insofar as it supports DEI. Right. DEI isn't a supplement. It's kind of it's the main thing. Right. So that's what we're seeing right now. And just to conclude, DEI is not a direct descendant of the civil rights movement. Right. People argue over whether Martin Luther King would be okay with this. I think it's clear he wouldn't be. But there are people out there who think, well, this is a progress and he would have gauged the situation and done the same thing. I don't know. That's fodder for another podcast. But that in a nutshell is critical social justice.
Interesting. I want to perhaps jump ahead a few points because Professor Smith, you had mentioned the term critical social justice, and I want to contrast this with another term used in the article, liberal social justice. Can you expound on these concepts for the lay reader who may not have the academic background and help to contextualize liberal social justice, critical social justice, and why one is perhaps more pernicious than the other and deviates away from the original intent of DEI?
Liberal or classical liberal social justice It aligns with the Enlightenment values. It aligns with the principles of equality, free speech, individuality. A lot of the things that were meant or understood to be the foundation of American society. I think if you do classical liberalism correctly, it is social justice, which is to say you're not denying people resources based on their skin color or anything like that. In fact, the original definition of affirmative action was just that. A, don't discriminate based on skin color, and B, make sure everybody has access to the same resources, right? And that idea is more aligned with classical liberal social justice, whereas critical social justice is something a lot more illiberal, motivated by Marxist ideology and postmodernist praxis. And what I mean by that is that language is, manipulated, redefined. Suddenly things that are completely innocuous are racist, right? Certain microaggressions, things you can ask people, are inherently racist, right? So that's what's going on. Another thing, and this is very important, classical liberal social justice has room for critical social justice as an ideology. What I mean by that is, we can discuss critical social justice with classical liberal social justice proponents, right? The other way, vice versa, is not the case. If you are a critical social justice proponent, you do not tolerate the classical liberal approach. You don't mention it. You don't give it any kind of respect, right? And that is by design as well. That's kind of part of what it is to be a critical social justice proponent. You block out anything that doesn't align with the ideology.
Interesting. And you mentioned microaggressions. I know Dr. Singer, as a general surgeon, will complete some of the continuing medical educations. And in the article, they talk about macro versus microaggressions and how it just simply doesn't fall in line with the fundamentals of surgery. Dr. Singer, can you expound a little bit on how, when you see these DEI initiatives appear, how they're so perhaps esoteric to your practice of medicine?
I wouldn't even say esoteric. I would say outside of the practice of medicine. For example, when we're taking maintenance of certification classes to maintain our board certification, we would expect to be listening to lectures or demonstrations that deal with the management of certain surgical problems and the latest thinking about what's the optimal approach to a surgical problem, what medications you might want to use in this situation, et cetera, how to handle certain complications. But when you get into subjects like what's the difference between a microaggression and macroaggression, which is now, we're now seeing in some of these classes that we're taking to maintain our certification, where the first thing that comes to mind is, well, what does this have to do with me performing surgery? Where does this come in? This is actually a waste of, I understand I'm required to get a certain amount of hours to maintain my certification, but this isn't an hour put to good use. This isn't an hour that makes me any better or more knowledgeable at being a surgeon. So that's another feature of why we think this has no place in medical education. Medical education is to teach you how to be a good physician or surgeon. And this is taking away from valuable time. There's so much to learn, as you know, Jay, in our profession. And it's dynamic. I mean, our understandings, our knowledge base is changing on a daily basis. And this is a distraction from what we need to be keeping up on.
I think you mentioned valuable. I would almost contend that it's an issue of prioritizing values. And this is really a question for both of you. As a physician, the values that I learned in medical school and residency tend to focus on patient care, patient-centric behavior, looking at the patient as an individual, avoiding these preconceived judgments or notions. perhaps the argument can be made that when we misappropriate some of the DEI initiatives or how they're maliciously presented, it creates a value system that's antagonistic, perhaps, to what's fundamental in medicine?
I think it could, yes. I mean,
we're supposed to take that one.
Yeah, we're supposed to look at patients as individuals. And as we mentioned in our article, speaking for myself, on multiple occasions as a surgeon, I've had to operate on an emergency basis on people who just on a, you know, they've had swastika tattoos, white power tattoos. Some of them had also been verbally very racist during the post-op period as well, when I'm rounding on them afterwards. But it's our, at least the way I was trained, I took an oath just to take care of the patient and do no harm and do what I can to get this patient well. And my personal opinions on this patient and his viewpoints are irrelevant to that. And if this patient has committed a crime or something like that, well, in many cases, these patients, they were I'm talking about gunshot wound victims who were oftentimes brought into the emergency department by the police. And I just tell myself, well, whatever this person did to get shot, that's the police will deal with that. My job is just to get this guy alive and off the table. And we were trained that way. But if we're going to start from the beginning to be trained to look at people on the basis of a hierarchy of virtue, you know, the oppressor versus the oppressed, I think that's going to infect our way of relating to patients. And some patients obviously are worthy of better care than other patients looking at things that way. We've already seen articles in the medical literature suggesting that maybe we should prioritize recipients of kidney transplants because, you know, organs are in scarce supply. So maybe you ought to prioritize it based upon where people stand in the hierarchy of victimhood, as opposed to who needs it more urgently, which is the way I was taught to think about it. So I think this is, it runs the risk of changing medicine into just another sort of organ of an ideologically driven state. I mean, think about what happened to doctors. We're still wondering, there's still articles being written about it. How could the medical profession in Nazi Germany find itself engaging in live human experiments, advocating certain people, like, for example, who have mental disabilities or not, let alone of different ethnic backgrounds, being quote-unquote euthanized? How could a medical profession that's devoted to healing and easing suffering come to do that kind of thing, even in, you know, down to inventing, like, the agents used for killing people? But if you start using, and I guess again, I don't want to, Eric knows more about this than me, but it's the same kind. I would think it's if you ideologize a profession, this is what could happen, where the doctors coming out are not trained to think of themselves as dedicated to healing patients, but instead as instruments of the state.
Yeah, critical social justice proponents, the people, many of the people who are heading DEI initiatives, they're not so much thinking as they are abiding by a particular narrative, and things have to fit into that narrative, right? The narrative is the lens through which you see all, and this narrative is one of systemic and inherent racism throughout society, throughout institutions. In which everything was designed to uphold white supremacy and to oppress those who aren't white. That is the narrative. Now, everything has to fit into that narrative. Then you're going to do things that, like I said before, are not pragmatic, but they're ideological. You know, you're going to perform this narrative as opposed to do what needs to be done for this particular situation. So it's decidedly anti-intellectual in that sense. There's no critical thinking going on. There's a lot of critical feeling. You know, I'll say that, and I'll use critical in the critical social justice sense, which is really counter-hegemonic, pushing back against the mainstream, right? In this situation, white Americans, right? Mostly. So yeah, that's it's abiding by a social reality and narrative and not the dictates of the situation.
Yeah, certainly. I felt like the article touched on this, but also took a balanced approach in identifying a few key components that I think are worth discussing. One was the concept of mandating this type of initiative in medical education versus giving medical students the opportunity to pursue it through other routes like medical humanities. The question I really have is very fundamental is, why do these initiatives tend to take things too far? I personally see certain value in at least exploring these topics, but inevitably we see them just go too far. Why is there that precipice? Why don't people just not recognize there's value in thinking or at least conceptualizing these principles, but then stopping at a certain point where, like you'd mentioned, you're not beholden to the narrative?
You want to take that one, Eric?
Yeah.
Why do things go too far? When I answer this question, I feel like I sound like a conspiracy theorist. But at the risk of sounding that way again, I will answer it. Going too far is the point. Critical social justice proponents, many of them, all critical social justice proponents, but many DEI leaders and things like that, they don't want reform so much as they want revolt. They want to replace the current system with one that is more conducive to their ideas, right? Those ideas being more communal as opposed to individual, more aligned with group consciousness as opposed to, you know, the sovereignty of the individual or something like that. So if you take things too far, you destabilize things. If you destabilize things, then those things are easier to topple. So the extremes are the point. That is the goal.
That's an interesting perspective. Why did you then try to take, let's say, not so much address the issue of this inevitability towards extremism, and then identify more balanced perspectives? It would appear that if certain individuals want a more extreme outlook, offering a more balanced solution like medical humanities or whatnot may not be what they would see as a solution as well. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. Yes. Medical humanities does not go far enough, right, and what it's doing. And let's say that statement is true. And there are ways to reform it so that it does go far enough. But that's not the point of all this, right? Again, the point is destabilization. It's, tearing down what's currently up and everything that is valued by it.
That's interesting.
So go ahead. Because there are increasing medical humanities courses available, and I think the first one in the country, University of Texas at Galveston, which is the oldest medical school in Texas, I think they were the first ones to offer a combined MD and a PhD in medical humanities for those who wanted that track. But my understanding of the way medical humanities should be, of course, is like as a liberal education, like in liberal arts, which is you would be exposed to these theories, but you'd also be exposed to the counter theories, and you would discuss it and make your own mind up. But I don't want to repeat what Eric just said, but maybe part of the problem is if you relegate it to medical humanities, first of all, you're not allowing it to use the practice of medicine as a way to further its mission because it's relegated to a separate area. But on top of that, in a true medical humanities course, it's discussed as an idea and batted around as an idea as opposed to taught as a dogma. Does that make sense to you, Eric?
Yes. Yes. You said that well.
Thanks. And I think that to your point earlier, Professor Smith, was that by constructing a narrative and form-fitting everything into that narrative, you prevent dialogue, you prevent debate, and allowing whatever is a general consensus to manifest organically.
Precisely, because what you're doing with that narrative is you're projecting that narrative onto a situation. Instead of walking into that situation, engaging it, and acting, speaking accordingly, right? You meet somebody, you project the narrative onto them based on their skin color. And now you know who they are. They have a certain role in that narrative. They're the protagonist, they're the antagonist, they're the ally or something like that. And that person doesn't have a real chance of expressing himself or herself and having some say in how they're interpreted, right? Mm-hmm. So the narrative, again, is there to replace critical thinking.
Yeah.
I think that's what you describe as prescriptive race. Right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And that's when there's like a script, you know, here's how a Black person acts, here's how a white person acts. And if you don't abide by that script, there's something wrong with you. You know, you're ostracized, you know, in some way. Right. So and that happens to Black people. It happens to white people. Black people do it to each other. White people do it to Black people. You know, white people have complained that I wasn't acting Black. You know, that is a thing. And that's part of critical social justice. Critical social justice does not work without prescriptive racism. It is prescriptive racism.
Interesting. I want to bring in a topic out of left field, but I think this is really valuable, and I think you two would be the right people to answer this. In medicine, there's this notion on implicit biases that affect the patient encounter. And as a professor of rhetoric, I'm sure you have a particularly nuanced understanding of the power of words and phraseology. We often see disparate outcomes among genders, among race. Those numbers, I've often felt, are almost kind of, to your point about prescriptive racism, in the sense that those data points can then be used to conjecture a narrative. In your opinion, how do we avoid that tendency? How do we look at the data from implicit biases in a way that encourages dialogue?
Well, I'm a big fan of self-awareness. Self-management, things like that. I wrote significantly a few years ago about empowerment theory and how that can come into play. What I mean by empowerment theory is that, you know, when it comes to human interaction, there are three major components that can empower and help us acquire some agency, not just for ourselves, but for and with others. There's the intrapersonal component, which is self-awareness. How are we speaking to ourselves? What kind of beliefs do we have and why? The good thing about implicit bias as a concept is that it does prompt people to think about their thinking. Where do they get that belief? Why do they still have that belief? Should they get rid of that belief, right? Then you get into the interactional component, which is once you have successfully undergone the intrapersonal, now you're able to talk to people without projecting that narrative onto them. Right. Because now you're aware that you have that narrative. Right. And you're a little more careful about it. You're making a concerted effort to see that person for who he or she is. The third component is behavioral, which I shorten into teamwork. How do we work together? How do we collaborate? Right. Based on or despite our differences. Right. One term is called superordinate goals. And that is when two disparate groups have the same goal that they can't reach by themselves. They have to work together. Right. And if you're going to work together successfully, the intrapersonal and interactional components of empowerment need to be in place. So that's a long-winded way of saying we have to get to know ourselves better. We have to do the best we can to not project ideas onto others before we talk about them. And we need to value teamwork and working with people who aren't like us.
In the article, there was an analogy of an example of a case where students were segregated and then told to learn about their own racial beliefs or their own perhaps racist constructs. What you had mentioned makes so much intuitive sense, even for somebody as myself who isn't studied in rhetoric. Why do people want to separate and then learn these concepts? Where does that idea come from where we need to separate people in order to develop a sense of understanding of racism or at the very least racial tendencies?
This is kind of a materialistic take on rhetoric. How you say something will be affected by who's in the room, right? So if you are concerned that you have a question, but you don't want to offend anybody, you know, you will be likely to agree that, hey, let's just go over here where we can talk to each other so I don't end up, you know, accidentally committing a microaggression or something like that. I get the separation to talk about things. What I don't get is the continued separation, right? Gayatri Spivak is a theorist, post-colonial theorist, who recognized the benefit of what she calls strategic essentialism. So for now, we're going to get together. We're going to have the same ideas. We're going to talk as a unit right now because we need to do that. Right? And once we've acquired the goal we're trying to achieve, we can jettison that idea. We can put it away for another day. The strategic part is being taken out. So now it's just essentialism. Now, white people can only talk to white people. It's their positionality that they'll never understand a black person because they are white, no matter how much they talk. That's the idea now, this idea of positionality and how it's basically a life sentence once you're born. You know, you can't possibly understand somebody of another race, which is antithetical to everything I do as a rhetorician. My whole point is that I think communication is valuable and necessary, especially for a free and pluralistic society, right? A free, liberal, pluralistic society, right? So you can't say things like, oh, you're white, you can't understand this part, so we can't talk. We shouldn't even have a conversation. That's literally what people are saying. That is literally a prominent stance in DEI and critical social justice. You're not even worth talking to. You'll never get it. That's that. Hmm. That is a recipe for disaster.
You know, as I'm listening to this, some thoughts occurred to me that I'd like to get your opinion on, Eric, and also Jay. Liberalism is actually, when you think about it, it goes against the grain of how we've evolved, if you believe in evolutionary psychology, so that, you know, our ancestors were all, they worked effectively in groups as, you know, as when we were hunter-gatherers, you know, there was those that were a more cohesive unit that viewed the other units as other and perhaps even a threat to whatever they've hunted and gathered, that's kind of built into nowadays to the way, you know, our circuitry. And so the Enlightenment era ideas of judging each one as an individual, not as a member of a group, and treating each one accordingly, that kind of goes against the way we're wired. And you need to work on it, I think. That's why it took so long to happen. And I'm wondering if you could almost look at this return to group identity as just, you know, sliding back into the ways in which we are evolutionarily wired. What do you think about that, Eric?
I wonder about that, and I'm not an evolutionary psychologist by any means, but I wonder about that because, yes, okay, so we're tribal in nature. We like to get together in groups and do things in groups. Does that tribalism have to be based on race? I mean, I'm a black male cis hetero. I really identify as a Philadelphia Eagles fan. So that's, I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan, American, right? And we are multicultural, right?
Right.
The only thing we have in common is our love for the Eagles and our hate for the Dallas Cowboys. That's it. So does it have to be race? I understand that tribalism is a part of the human experience, but does it have to be race? That's the issue that I always think about when I hear about that.
Yeah, Professor Smith, I think that's a great point. I don't believe it has to be about race, but I would also add that tribalism is reductionist by nature. It tends to favor the most simple. And when we look around, what is the most apparent difference is things that are racial in nature. So I feel like tribalism, if left unchecked, does predispose to racial beliefs. But I also feel like tribalism, that ethos, can be used in positive ways if structured the right way in society. So I don't necessarily see it as something that's an absolute good or an absolute bad. I see it as a group tendency that is inherent to the human experience that can be bad or can be good if it's structured in the right way. And I'm curious, again, as a primary care physician, I'm no expert in this. I'm simply conjecturing based on my own observations. I'm curious to see if you see any value in that sentiment.
I see value if people aren't compelled to join a particular quote unquote tribe or something like that. I like the idea of free association.
Yeah.
You know, yes, we are all interdependent, but I can choose with whom I'm interdependent, you know, and work with them. If I'm placed in a group against my will because of one thing or another, some immutable characteristic, that's a different story altogether. Yeah. Like, that's prescriptive racism.
Yeah.
Right. You belong over there. And the fact that you're not over there means there's something wrong with you. You're a traitor to your race, or you're suffering from false consciousness or something like that.
Taking it back to medicine and seeing how these principles can apply to medicine, one of the beliefs that I would say some of the more jaded physicians have is simply that there's no way to prove that there's value or no value in this, meaning the structure of these conversations, whether that's in a more free associative medical humanities context or something that's more imposed or extreme like DEI, does it really matter in the end? And I know that's kind of an overly simplistic way to look at things, but I think the issue a lot of people have is really correlating the outcomes with the process, or at least the methodologies. And for those individuals who may not appreciate that, how would you help them to understand and bridge that gap?
I relate to what you're saying, because I've been trying to figure out how to write an article or a longer piece that I want to title, So What? That's what I want the title to be, you know? These Enlightenment values came from Europeans. Okay. And, you know, I mean, I know the history of this country, but unless you have a time machine and an army, I don't know what you're going to do about that. There's nothing practical to do about that. As I said earlier, there is a lack of pragmatism in all of this. Right. So we want to get to a certain place where, people of color are in a good place, basically. Right. They have their rights. They have justice and things like that. How do we get there? There is nothing practical about the current critical social justice narrative if you're trying to reach that goal, you know. If you're trying to destroy things, destabilize things, it makes a lot of sense, right? But if you're trying to achieve those goals that I just mentioned, this is completely nonsensical, right? So a healthy level of pragmatism would be nice, but they would literally tell you this, pragmatism is a white way of knowing, so.
Expand on that. That was a very interesting phrase, and I feel like you left the audience hanging. It was a very clever phrase. Could you please expand on that?
Well, I can't take credit for it. it's something that has been lodged at people who, you know, demand reason and rationality. They demand, punctuality, right? They value delayed gratification and self-reliance and things like that. For us to want to have a, conversation based on reason and logic, that is to abide by a white way of knowing, right? Now, I've been told this, I've been accused of this, right? By trying to have a, good faith intellectual conversation with somebody. He basically said, your use of logic and rationality, is inherently white and therefore oppressive to me. I have the email. I'm not making this up. So that's what I mean by that. And white ways of knowing can be anything from, the scientific method to, valuing self-reliance.
So if we have to abandon logic and the scientific method, then what happens to civilization?
Exactly.
Very interesting stuff here. I think this is as perfect a time to segue into perhaps some of the concluding remarks, because I think that this can go on forever. And it's an issue that I believe the audience should follow Professor Eric Smith and Dr. Jeffrey Singer on, because it's important to get a balanced perspective on this, and this is exactly what they're providing. In the remaining time that we have, perhaps Dr. Singer first and Professor Smith after that, what do you hope readers get out of the article and how they can perhaps implement it, whether they're in the medical field or as a patient? How can they implement the principles set forth in that article?
Well, what I hope they get is that, first of all, when you're in a professional school learning a profession, whether it's medicine, dentistry, the law, any sort of profession that requires you to get a skill set, then suddenly bringing up and infusing that with current critical social justice theory or moderate, that's what really DEI is these days, not only is a distraction from what students in these fields need, it's actually devoting valuable time to something that's not directly germane to what they're there for, which could impact on the quality of a graduate you're going to have and their knowledge base. But it also tends to make them view humans that they're supposed to be devoted to, in the case of medicine, the healing. It tends to make them view the humans in a hierarchical manner, where some humans are better than other humans, which is anathema to our professional ethic. So it should just be removed from medical education. And the other thing is that if you do that, it could lead, as we say in our paper, it could lead to very, very horrific places, as it has done in the past.
I hope people realize when they see the article that they don't have to buy this stuff. You know, there are people out here who value diversity, equity, and inclusion in the original senses of those words and simply don't like this particular methodology, right? And those people can agree that, we're not done regarding racial justice. You know, they can agree on, certain things that cause disparities. They can agree that there are disparities, but that doesn't mean they agree on how to deal with those disparities, right? How to deal with racial injustice. That's what's going on here. This methodology is flawed, and that's putting it nicely. There are better ways to do this.
Well said. Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.